Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to episode 223. Today you'll hear the success story of a woman named Valerie. She's a 34-year-old Pinterest manager and strategist who enjoys hiking, biking, and trying new things with her family. About 6 months into trying to conceive, Valerie consulted her OBGYN. He reluctantly ran several blood tests and told her everything came back normal. A year later, and still not pregnant, Valerie and her husband went to a fertility clinic. Her TSH was high, so she was put on thyroid medication, but her other test results were normal. Her doctor recommended either IUI or IVF, but she was not mentally ready for IVF and felt the success rate of IUI was too low. She consulted an endocrinologist who ran additional testing and diagnosed her with Hashimoto's and low vitamin D. Shortly thereafter, they moved to a new state for her husband's job. She stopped eating gluten, and while her stomach issues disappeared, her doctor suspected she wasn't ovulating or had a luteal phase defect. Let's listen to how Valerie changed fertility clinics, took a high dose of Femara to stimulate ovulation, and became pregnant with her daughter. Hi, Valerie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Why don't we start by hearing a little bit about you? How old are you? What do you do for a living? And what do you do for fun?
So I'm 34 and I am a stay-at-home mom, a blogger, and a Pinterest manager. And for fun, I like to go to the gym, and my husband and I like to go hiking, biking, hang out with our dogs and our daughter. Just do find fun things to get into. Every now and then we like to travel. So that's pretty much it. That's our life.
Think about your life before infertility. Back then, how would you describe yourself as a person?
Pretty much the same as I am now. A anxious perfectionist. And I like to make plans. So before infertility, we had a plan in place and it didn't go as planned, obviously. I would say I just like to be prepared, and I wasn't prepared.
Tell me about the first time you met your husband.
We were seniors in high school, believe it or not. We had some friends introduce us. They thought we would be good together. At the time, I was friends with the girlfriend and he was best friends with the boyfriend. And we went bowling and it was our last frame. And they're like, I dare you guys to kiss each other. And like, if you get a strike, you have to kiss each other. And I kid you not, the very last frame, we got a strike and we had to kiss each other. And then, I mean, the rest is history from there.
I have to say, that is a very unique story. I've never had like a bowling dare as how they met their husband.
Me either. It's crazy. Yeah, I don't think I'll ever forget that. That's the one memory that will definitely stand out in my mind all the time.
Today, how would you describe you and your husband as a couple?
We're good. We complete each other. He's the carefree, doesn't necessarily take everything seriously. And I'm the one who takes everything seriously, keeps us in line, keeps us together in a different way. So like, he's the jokester and I'm the serious one.
Was there a specific moment in your life when you first knew you wanted to be a mom?
I don't think it really hit me until I knew I always wanted to be a mom, but I think it didn't really set in until we were trying to conceive. Like, we had a timeline, and when that timeline was up, you knew you were ready. And so then that's really when it hit me, like, okay, this is what I'm meant to do. That's really, I think, after our 5-year mark is when it hit me that that's what I really, really wanted to do with my life.
And how did longing to be a mom impact other decisions in your life?
I don't think it necessarily impacted my decisions once we were trying to conceive. I think I started withholding in more, like being more secluded, I would guess you could say, just because almost anything could trigger a crying session.
Well, how about, did it impact your career or where you chose to live? Any of that stuff?
No, not really. I grew up where we were living, not where we live now, but where we were living at the time. And work, I was a teacher. So it impacts you when it happens to someone else where they're like, oh, I wasn't even trying and I got pregnant. And then it hits you. And then the emotional toll takes. And then you start kind of backing away from people and start, and you know, you stop talking to people less and things like that. But I opened up to my friends before I opened up to my family. So I can't say, and I'm a huge talker. So like, I need to talk things out. So I don't think it really impacted me in a way that it might have impacted other people in such a way. I think I have to talk and get out there. And then you got my husband who's like, we can't be down about it. We gotta keep going regardless of what happens. And you know, you grieve about it, you cry about it when you need to, and then you just gotta keep going, was our mentality at the time.
Let's dive into the journey to build your family. Take us through your whole infertility timeline, starting at the beginning.
So we got married in 2010, and we said, okay, we're going to be married for 5 years, enjoy each other, travel, do all the things. And then in 5 years, we'll talk about having babies. Honestly, infertility wasn't on my radar at all. I have a regular period. I've had one since I was 10. They're heavy, but that's not even something I even remotely thought about. We went off the pill at 5 years, and I was really stressed with work. So we didn't try because it was my first year of teaching, and stress with trying to conceive is not really the best idea. We went on, and I would say about 4 months in, I was like, why is this not happening? And 4 months in is when I knew. And I went to see my OBGYN. He goes, well, you get a period every single month, so you must be ovulating. I'll test your thyroid just to pacify you. And he tested my prolactin as well. And then he talked about me outside my room, how I'm just pacifying this girl. And we're just doing these things. There's nothing wrong with her. So fast forward a year, because they recommend that you wait one whole year. I never once got pregnant. I would have moments where I would go period would be 4 days early or it'd be 4 days late. So part of me would wonder, okay, am I having a chemical pregnancy? Did I maybe get pregnant? But I never actually got a positive pregnancy test. 1 year later, we go to a fertility clinic where we were living at the time, and she did all the tests. She tested my thyroid. She only tested the TSH and put me on thyroid medicine because it was above 2. So according to her, your thyroid needs to be below 2 to conceive, 2 or below to conceive. And after that, diagnosed my husband and myself with unexplained infertility. Basically told us our only options were IUI or IVF. And you're talking at this particular clinic, it was $8,000 for an IUI and over $10,000 for IVF. And you're still, for me, it's really hard to say, okay, yeah, let's do this, because you're still not guaranteeing me results. I have unexplained infertility. You don't know what's going on. So how do you know this is going to work? And so we went back to the drawing board. We took our diagnosis and our options, and I cried because I just didn't think I was ever going to have a baby of my own. We started talking about adoption, but just, you have to be in the right mindset about adoption. So we started talking about that. In between all this time, my husband gets a job offer to move and to open an office for his company in a different state. With that, I mean, it was kind of a no-brainer, because if he was here doing it, it would have been a lot longer to get the promotion. So we moved, and then I went to an endocrinologist. And the endocrinologist actually was going through the same thing that I was going through, but she had gone through IVF, but she was diagnosed with unexplained infertility and everything. And she ran more tests than my fertility doctor ran. She tested my TSH, my T4, my T3, my free T4, antibodies for my thyroid. She tested my vitamin D. She tested, which my fertility doctor did not test vitamin D, which is also important for fertility. She tested my AMH again. So there was a lot of other tests that she had done that my fertility doctor didn't do. And turns out that I ended up having Hashimoto's, which can play a role in your fertility, because if you're producing low thyroid, then your pituitary can mess with your ovulation with your pituitary gland and it releasing hormones. So you could have ovulation issues as well as thyroid issues. So there was that. And I went through, and still, that was a few months after seeing a fertility doctor, and still wasn't conceiving, even though my thyroid was under control probably about 4 or 5 months in, and I still wasn't conceiving. So about 6 months from there, I decided so Hashimoto's, it's recommended that everything I've read recommends you give up gluten. I was diagnosed back before I graduated college with IBS because I had a really bad episode of not being able to keep food down. And she didn't test me for celiac disease. She immediately just said, oh, you have IBS. I'm not even going to test you for celiac. So even IBS is recommended that you give up gluten. I had been stubborn about giving up gluten for several years. And finally, in April, that was about 6 months after getting the actual diagnosis that I said, okay, I'm just going to give up gluten. I'm just going to see how it goes. All my stomach problems completely disappeared. My stomach problems disappeared. My pain disappeared. I lost 10 pounds. Even before that, seeing other OBGYNs suggested that I might have PCOS, and they wanted just to see how my thyroid was going to do. I saw another OBGYN who told me that I wasn't ovulating. My number was 8 at her office, and at the fertility clinic, it was a 9. I honestly don't really know quite what those numbers are supposed to be, but I know they're supposed to be higher than that, technically, I guess, if you're ovulating. So she would tell me that I wasn't ovulating. The fertility clinic told me I was ovulating. No matter what, I was still getting my period. And so when I gave up gluten, we moved to the new state. I found a new fertility doctor. She redid my blood work and the ultrasounds, and she actually said that I was presenting normally. And she tested me for celiac, but at that point, I'd been off gluten for 4 months. So it's not necessarily an accurate test because we don't know still if I have celiac or not, because you have to be on gluten for a minimum of 6 weeks to actually have accurate test results, because you have to be taking it or eating it. Sorry. She was afraid of that of PCOS, even though I have no symptoms of PCOS. So I don't know why I was looking that way, but I mean, I was getting normal ultrasounds, normal blood work. And she said I started presenting more normally since I'd given up gluten, because after she looked at all my test results and everything, she was comfortable giving me the Femara for ovulation instead of jumping straight to IVF or IUI, because she said I was presenting normally now, and that she felt like that I could handle that. And she was happy to do the less invasive one first, which our fertility clinic and my OBGYN did not offer us. So we've never even tried those things prior to this point. So we're going on year 2, almost to the date of us trying to conceive, and then in exactly a year from our first fertility clinic. And we're trying the Femara route, and that's when we actually were successful the first time. And that's our journey in a nutshell for the most part.
You consulted your OBGYN about 6 months in. I'm curious, what sign did you have that you thought you were having troubles?
Well, because I was regular. I mean, my period was on point. I mean, on birth control, off birth control, I was having a period. I was getting those smiley faces on the, I left that part out. I was getting the smiley faces on the ovulation predictor kits. So why wasn't it happening? And it's actually uncommon, supposedly, that you conceive on the first try, and it does take longer. But I just felt like something wasn't, gut instinct, to long story short, a gut instinct that there was something that wasn't right.
You ended up going to 2 fertility clinics, so I'd love to hear about what your experience was with both of them.
I really like the second one, and I highly recommend it. I talk about them more so a lot in my blog. I felt listened to at the second one. The most important part is I felt listened to. The staff was very, very nice, always, you know, considerate of everyone who walked in. I don't think there was anyone that I talked to that I ever felt uncomfortable with. At our first one, we had most interaction with a nurse practitioner, really liked her a lot. But when we would interact with the doctor, I just never, especially when she gave us our options, I felt like they were looking for our money as opposed to actually trying to figure out what was wrong with us. And I did not get that vibe at our second one, at our second fertility clinic.
And at your second place, you had to travel quite a distance, correct?
We had to go, it's about 2.5 hours from where we live. And the fertility clinic that's closest to us actually does not have a very good reputation. So I found this one and I was hooked. And they can do blood work where we live from at LabCorp. So I didn't always, unless I was doing an ultrasound, I didn't have to go to their office. So that was nice.
I want to circle back to your thyroid condition. How do you think the thyroid can affect conception based on what you've been told?
Actually, I haven't been told anything. I've did some research and I did brush up on some of this before, so it'd be fresh on my mind. Based on what I've been reading, it can mess with your ovulation if you're doing low amounts of hormone, getting low amounts of, so if you have hypothyroidism and that you're putting in low levels of thyroid and it interferes with your ovulation, so you're not getting out the necessary hormones that you need for ovulation. So you need estrogen and all that to ovulate. If you're not getting that from your thyroid, then it's not happening, even if you do have your period. So I've discovered that. And then it goes along with, it can also cause, if you actually are having thyroid issues and you're not having it regulated by a doctor, then you're likely for miscarriage and that you are likelihood of. So it's really important for it to be, you know, regulated and under control. And it can even happen, you get thyroid issues also during pregnancy. That's also important for it to be regulated then too, to make sure you're not, you know, with stillbirths and things like that. So thyroid is a huge workhorse of the body and it's important for it to be under control. Mine had always been between two and three. So I've always been told it was normal, always. But when I was younger, I could sleep 12 hours and still wake up exhausted and just could go back to sleep. That's not normal. And so if it's not out of the normal range, a lot of doctors won't test more than your TSH. And that's the other problem, is that we're not testing everything that needs to be tested just because it's not in a certain range or out of a certain range. So I happened to just find a doctor who was willing to test everything. And though my antibodies weren't high, she basically said, you've tested positive for antibodies, it doesn't matter how high it is. So now I have this autoimmune disease called Hashimoto's, which can affect your fertility, basically be testing your ovulation. So self-diagnosing, since Femara worked, I would say I had an ovulation issue that no one diagnosed and no one bothered to try to diagnose.
So even after you came back with a high thyroid and the antibodies, no one talked to you about how this might impact your fertility and you had to do your own research?
Pretty much. Even my doctor, she just basically put me on thyroid medicine. The other OBGYN I saw, she said, well, you've just started thyroid medication. I just kind of want to see how everything levels out, because she just wanted, basically she implied that being regulating my thyroid should help things move along. And I still didn't get pregnant after that either.
Do you think that everyone should have their thyroid tested?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it should be appropriately tested. Just your TSH is only what's being put out by your pituitary gland. So even if you're functioning at let's say the normal levels of a TSH is between 0.4 and 4 milli international units per liter. Whether you need to know the units or not is irrelevant. But I'd only had an abnormal reading on my thyroid once, and they only tested my TSH again. And when it went back down to normal levels, they weren't worried about it anymore. So I had always been at a 3 or higher. Sometimes I was at a 2, and I'm still really tired. So I think it's really important to know your symptoms. So if your fatigue is a big one, for me it was, sleep, insomnia. I have insomnia. I go back and forth with insomnia now. Anxiety. So anything like that. The anxiety could be another issue too, a symptom that everyone overlooks. Know the symptoms, know your body, and find someone. If your doctor won't do it, find someone who will. I mean, that's my biggest thing, is to advocate for yourself, because no one else is going to do it for you. No doctor is going to do it. And really push for testing, especially if you think that that's an issue. I've thought that that had been an issue since I was 16 and no one would test it. I couldn't get anyone to test past the TSH. They wouldn't test my T3, my T4, my antibodies. They wouldn't test any of it just because I was in the normal range. So they said I was fine.
It's so crazy too, because it's just a blood test. It's not like there's anything super special about it.
Exactly. And that's all you have to do, is just run a blood test. And they're like, no, your labs are normal. You don't need to do that. So they wouldn't do it.
You mentioned it briefly, but what exactly is Hashimoto's?
So it's an autoimmune disease where your body is basically attacking your thyroid gland. And a lot of people will call it hypothyroidism, but it's more of a disease as opposed to a condition. It's regulated. I take thyroid medication, so it's regulated with thyroid medication, and it's just monitored. So I see an endocrinologist, and it's monitored that way. So it's treated as if it's hypothyroidism, but I do go back and forth, especially like the anxiety is hyperthyroidism typically. And that's, I think hyperthyroidism is one that no one talks about. That's really, can get really scary. I don't know enough about that one to talk about it, but it's, the symptoms of that one, you really should take a look at too as well, because Graves' disease is very dangerous. People die from that and it's undiagnosed. But I'll get off that soapbox. Hashimoto's, again, it's just a autoimmune disease. And it's where your body attacks your thyroid gland and not making enough thyroid hormones to get what my body needs. So I have to take medicine for it.
I know you guys never confirmed whether or not you have celiac disease, but what have you learned since about what that is and how it can affect conception?
So celiac is also another autoimmune disease where the only cure is to stop eating gluten. It's basically little holes in your intestines that basically gluten, when you eat gluten, it's burning holes into your intestines. And it's like a leaky, it's almost, you can call it leaky gut, but it's not that. I call it leaky gut because of the holes. Going through that, and when you're digesting food like gluten, it becomes painful. And some people have diarrhea, some are sick, some are like sick for days, some are throwing up. Get migraines and headaches. Symptoms vary from person to person. So for me, I don't know that I have it. I have a lot of the symptoms. I do have IBS, which is also a symptom of celiac disease. And you have to be very careful with gluten and cross-contamination. So, you know, those French fries, they're gluten-free, but they're being fried with the fried chicken and the fried pickles and all of those things. So those are technically not gluten-free now. So you can't eat those anymore. And some people are very sensitive to that and some people aren't. With celiac, you basically avoid gluten, which is a protein from wheat that's found in breads, flours. Some people use it as fillers and you'd find it's in soy sauce. So it's actually found in a lot of things that you wouldn't think it would be found in. Something you really have to be careful of. So I have a completely gluten-free diet now because of this and just because my stomach problems have gone away. There's no reason to continue to put yourself through that. And I'm not going to eat a bunch of gluten just to get tested.
Tell me how you felt when you finally received that Hashimoto's diagnosis.
I felt relieved. I felt validated. I was like, oh, okay, good. So maybe now something will start happening. Maybe we'll start having babies now. And you know, then you're like, okay, well then what's the point of this? What's the point of this diagnosis if, you know, there's still something else wrong? But initially I felt relieved and validated because I knew all along that something was wrong. That was the other thing when the fertility doctor put me on the thyroid medicine, I was like, oh, I feel better. So I needed to go see an endocrinologist. And so I finally did. I finally just decided I'm going to do this. Started doing stuff for myself, started realizing old enough to speak up for myself and do what needs to be done. I didn't need a referral, I got a recommendation from a friend and called an endocrinologist and got the diagnosis. And she validated it too, realizing that she goes, well, obviously there probably is something a little off if you're feeling better when you're on the thyroid medicine. It's nice to know that that's why sometimes I'm a little crazy.
And did your endocrinologist have to follow you throughout your pregnancy?
When she diagnosed us, she diagnosed us in November, and by May we were living in a different state. So I had to find a different endocrinologist. So when we got pregnant, the dose changed. So I was taking one pill Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and doubled the dose Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. That's how it went throughout my pregnancy. And I think every 3 months or so, I was getting blood tests just to make sure that my thyroid was still at the levels that it needed to be. So yes, I was monitored by an endocrinologist where we live now throughout pregnancy.
Tell me about the lowest point during your journey and how you recovered from it.
The lowest point was when we got our diagnosis and our options. And I felt utterly defeated. I felt guilty for being sad because there are so many kids in this world who need parents. And we're not opposed to adoption. It just wasn't my mental, it wasn't at my mental state. So I went home, I cried. I cried for days and I mean, for weeks, just thinking about the fact that this was never going to happen for us. And how do I move on from not having a baby ever of my own to wanting to adopt someone else's baby? At some point, you go through a process, a grieving process, and I just didn't know how I was ever going to get to a point where I could adopt. Knowing that I did want to, I didn't not want to, I just wasn't ready. So when would I be ready to do that and then be okay with me not having my own baby at the same time? And how could I still, that was me just questioning everything. So that was my lowest point was just questioning, how do I move on from this and be okay with it? And that was when we got our diagnosis and told that IUI and IVF were our only options. And for me, I couldn't spend the money knowing that it might not happen because I didn't have a diagnosis. Do I do it? Do I not do it? So I was asking myself a lot of questions and in a huge limbo at that time and just didn't know what to do. And that was when I finally told my mom. And I finally felt relief from that, just being able to talk about it with my mom, because my mom's like my best friend. It helped, but you're still, you know, when you talk about it, you cry because you don't know what's going to happen.
Just to clarify something you said there, even though you had this thyroid diagnosis, they were still calling you unexplained?
Yes. The fertility clinic didn't diagnose my thyroid, did not diagnose the Hashimoto's, a separate endocrinologist did. The fertility doctor only ran the TSH. So she didn't even test the T3. She didn't test the T4. She didn't test for antibodies. I asked her if she was going to do all that. And she said she was. And she actually only tested the TSH. So she only put me on thyroid medicine because my TSH was above 2. And she wasn't even concerned about anything else.
Tell me about a positive moment from your journey.
Finding out that gluten was a culprit of all my stomach problems, and then just realizing, hey, finally making that decision made me look normal on the inside to a doctor. Telling our fertility doctor, saying, you're presenting normal now because you gave up gluten, most likely, was amazing. And then I kicked myself because, well, why didn't you do it sooner? But hindsight is 20/20, and you move on. But the positive part was knowing, okay, I've gotten some diagnoses that I needed to get from the beginning that I've been begging for a long time. And now let's move forward. And it was positive from there on. Once I had given up gluten, it was just a positive interaction from there on. And I'm not necessarily always a positive person. So I'm working on that. And I think that was probably the turning point and where the positivity really started to begin, and where you knew that this was going to get better. It didn't matter how it was going to happen. It was going to happen.
Tell me about the moment when you first learned you were going to be a mom.
Oh, it was so exciting. I was by myself. And so, you know, when you're trying to conceive, you know, when you miss your period, and you're like, oh, you get really excited. But I'd been 4 days late before and it didn't mean anything. But we had taken the Femara. I was by myself and I was like, okay, I'm just going to go get a test. The most exciting part really was getting to tell my husband and getting to share that with him, because I was so excited to tell him, and I made him a little chalkboard sign telling him he's going to be a daddy. And I showed him, I put all the pregnancy tests in a Ziploc bag, and he was so excited. And I think that was the part for me where I was like, I couldn't wait. I was really nervous because I knew it's like a nervous excitement because you still know anything can happen. Then at the 6-week appointment, she actually was able to hear when we went back to the fertility clinic to confirm pregnancy. I think we were at 6 weeks at that point. You heard the heartbeat for the first time, which she prepared us. She goes, we might not hear it, but if we do. And so she put it on. And I mean, I cried because it's amazing. The sound that you'll never forget. You know, it's real and you're going to take care of it and it's going to be amazing.
Tell me about balancing work and having to go back and forth 2.5 hours to a fertility clinic.
So I wasn't quite working yet. So since I'm a teacher, we had gone during the summer. So I hadn't looked for a job yet. And it actually didn't look for a job until November. And I was already pregnant, which was you know, stressful in and of itself. But luckily I didn't have a job yet. So I didn't have to worry about that. So it made it a lot easier to go back and forth 2.5 hours. And now for my husband, luckily he only had to go once, and it was just me who needed to do testing after that and go over everything. So he didn't have to miss any work except for our initial appointment. So that was nice.
How did infertility change your relationship with your husband?
I think it made us a lot closer and made me realize that I can rely on him for things, for the big things, even though it may seem like you can't rely on your men for big things because they like to act like big children all the time. But when it matters, they step up, and he did. And he was my rock. I probably wasn't as good of a rock as he was because just an emotional mess, but he was pretty amazing. And I think it made us a lot closer, a lot more supportive of each other.
You said you're really close to your mom. So how did infertility impact your relationship with family and friends?
None of our family actually knew until we had our baby, except for my mom. My mom and my dad were the only ones who knew. And we didn't tell anybody else except for our friends. So it more so impacted my relationship mostly with my in-laws because they kept asking, okay, when are you giving us a grandbaby? When are you giving us a grandbaby? And even now, I'm very put off by that. It makes me upset that people ask that question. I think that I started distancing myself from her. My mother-in-law would ask more so than my father-in-law, and I started distancing myself from her. So I wouldn't want to go around. I had to bite my tongue a lot. I wouldn't talk a lot when we were around her. So I think it affected, they didn't really realize the effect of it. And they didn't even know until after that was what was happening. And I released my blog probably 3 months after my daughter was born. So then they read it, and then they found out. That's how they found out. I didn't tell them. They read it on my blog. So I don't know if that's probably a good thing or a bad thing.
And what was their reaction to that?
My mother-in-law said she cried the whole time and had no idea that that's what we were going through. But funny thing is that she's still asking me when the second one is coming. And I'm telling you, I don't know that I can conceive on my own still. And I just don't want to be asked that question. So I guess she read it and it touched her, but she didn't learn from the first time.
It's always shocked me that people ask that question. Like you said, I don't understand it. I have never asked anyone that question, to my knowledge. And like you said, the second Aurora was born, we were being asked when another child is coming. And it's like we went through so much to bring this baby into the world. Just chill for a second.
Yeah. I mean, just let us enjoy this one. And, you know, I have some friends who have gone through it and, you know, they've been able to actually surprisingly conceive on their own for the second time. But I don't know. A lot of things are still very similar to the first time that I'm just kind of like, I don't know if I'm still going to be able to do this on my own. The talks are out there, but whatever happens, happens at this point. I do find myself asking that. I don't ask the question. I ask, do you want them? Because I find myself not knowing what to ask. And especially if they've been married for a while, as much as I try to avoid it, I don't ask it necessarily. But if it comes up, it's like, well, do you want them? As opposed to like, when are you going to have them? Because not everybody wants kids. And just because they don't have them doesn't mean that they want them. So that's the other side of the story too. It's people asking, when are you having kids, to people who don't want them to. So it's a double-edged sword.
One of my sisters-in-law actually doesn't want kids, and that's a perfectly valid choice. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that. So you're totally right.
Yeah, my best friend doesn't want kids either. And she does go back and forth, but I think she ultimately doesn't want them. And so I'm sure people finally decided to stop asking. But, you know, people just, not everybody wants kids, and that doesn't have to be always part of the conversation. There's other things to talk about.
You said you started a blog. What was the rationale behind that? And what type of information have you shared there?
So I started a blog because I wanted to share our journey. My situation isn't necessarily unique, but I think it's important to tell people how they can advocate for themselves and some things to look out for, especially if you have unexplained infertility, because from a lot of things that I read, unexplained infertility isn't unexplained. There's something wrong. It's a matter of, okay, are you willing to find out what it is? So I shared our journey, everything that I've just talked about here. I've described it, all the fertility testing that we went through, our pregnancy journey. I've described that because I ended up with preeclampsia. So I felt like that was important to share because honestly, a lot of people don't talk about preeclampsia. We talked about our postpartum journey. I share mostly fertility and postpartum, but I did mostly it was for our journey. And so that people, someone out there could use our journey as an example and hopefully take it back to their doctor and say, well, maybe I'm having these kinds of symptoms too. Could you test this? Or even if you're not having those symptoms, can you test this to make me feel better? Because, you know, a good doctor will do that. And that's pretty much why I put it out there, so that women and men can advocate for themselves. I just released a post on ovulation disorders. There's a few things out there. So your pituitary gland can, anything going on with your pituitary gland can keep you from ovulating. So that's important. That goes along with your thyroid, because it's released from your pituitary gland and all that first. And I'm not going to get into it because I don't know the technical details of it, but anything like that. And, you know, not ovulating is a high number of reasons why women aren't getting pregnant. And you can have a period and not ovulate, or not ovulate when you think you're ovulating, or still get smiley faces like I was. And maybe you're just not ovulating enough. I find it really important to just get the word out. There's a story, there's someone that someone can see and compare it to how they're feeling, and then go advocate for themselves to their doctors, because that's what you have to do. You have to stand up for yourself because no one else is going to do it.
We don't often talk about the pregnancy side of things on the show, but you mentioned preeclampsia. For people who don't know what that is, can you tell us about that?
So preeclampsia is severe high blood pressure in pregnancy, and it's caused by something going on with the placenta. So usually you have protein in your urine and high blood pressure, like significant, well above 140 over 90. So 140 over 90 is the precaution range. And then I think I reached at one point, it was like 186 over 100, maybe at one point I reached. I spent 4 or 5 days in the hospital, but preeclampsia is severe high blood pressure. You can have headache. Protein in the urine is a big one. I actually never had protein in the urine, and you have to be careful because then your organs are going to start shutting down. And then preeclampsia turns into eclampsia. Or there's also HELLP, which I don't know much about that one, but they're all kind of tied to each other and all very severe, very, very scary. And they say the only thing to make them go away is to deliver the baby. I was on 2 weeks of bed rest. And then I still had preeclampsia after. So I had postpartum preeclampsia as well as preeclampsia during pregnancy. So I still was having high blood pressure readings, not as high as 180s over 100 or anything like that, but like 160s, 150s over like 90s kind of thing. So I was still on blood pressure medicine at least like two or three months after giving birth. I was still on blood pressure medicine, and I slowly was able to wean myself off of the blood pressure medicine. You can have it postpartum too. So it's really important to look out for it postpartum. I was having really bad headaches, like migraine type headaches postpartum. It was blood from the blood pressure being too high.
Was there anything else you had to do to take care of yourself postpartum other than taking a medication?
Resting and no, not really. You really just need to rest. Make sure if you've been prescribed blood pressure medication in pregnancy, your doctor tells you to keep taking it, you should definitely keep taking it until your doctor tells you that you can't take it. I had to go in for a blood pressure check with my doctor, and I still had to keep taking my medicine. And then at my 6 week appointment, he told me I could start weaning myself off. So I think I was taking 2 pills twice a day. So you can start taking 2 once a day. And then after that, you can take 1 twice a day and then 1 once a day. So I just weaned myself off of the medicine.
You had to deliver early because of this. Did you guys have to spend any time in the NICU?
Yes, we spent 2 weeks in the NICU. Our baby was 4 pounds when she was born. She ended up with jaundice. Most babies, they say, go on a feeding tube when they're in the NICU, depending on their gestational age and how they'll take a bottle. She was 34 weeks, almost 35 weeks. So she was technically 6 weeks early, but really 5 weeks early, because it doesn't matter if you're 34 weeks and 6 days, you're still 34 weeks. So they don't round up. So she was really close to 35 weeks gestation. And she spent 2 weeks in the NICU, basically learning how to eat. Luckily, regulating her body temperature. Luckily, we were since I was hospitalized at 32 weeks, they gave me the shot for steroids for her to develop her lungs. So she didn't have to go on breathing treatments or anything like, or breathing help with breathing in the NICU. She luckily didn't have to do that. She was breathing fine on her own. She just really needed help eating and growing and just regulating her body temperature.
We had a very similar experience. She was born at 33 weeks. And unfortunately, fortunately, I don't know, we weren't in the hospital before that. I actually showed up at the hospital and went into labor. So we didn't end up getting the shot because of that. But we also spent 18 days in the NICU for very similar reasons. So she was only 3 pounds when she was born. But luckily, her lungs were working just fine. I mean, we really, really lucked out. And mostly she had jaundice in the beginning. I mean, that's pretty standard. And then learning how to eat and regulate body temperature, we actually had to check her body temperature a ridiculous number of times a day for months after we came home. I don't know if you guys had to do that or what.
Oh, really? No. So we would, since when you're in the NICU, they kind of let the parent, they'll teach the parents how to do everything. And then they kind of leave you on your own. You're like, you're monitored somewhat. But every time she changed her diaper at the NICU, we had to check her temperature there. When we came home, it was more weighted feedings because we were hoping to be able to exclusively breastfeed without having to have the formula, the Neo. I don't know if you guys had to do the NeoSure formula as well, but we had to do that. And so I became obsessive with her weight and making sure she was gaining weight and hoping that I was going to get to breastfeed, and ended up exclusively pumping because breastfeeding was actually too much work for her. She was so good at it too. And I was so upset because she was really good at it, but it just was too much work as opposed to a bottle. Like a bottle is less work than having to breastfeed. So I exclusively pumped for 7 months and then had to do the NeoSure. So she never was able to come off of that until she was 6 or 7 months.
We would be here for a very long time if I went into my feeding issues. Long story short, Aurora ended up having a feeding disorder. And we also were not able to breastfeed. Like you said, it was too much work. She was so, so, so tiny. And she just wasn't growing, frankly. We ended up having to go into a special feeding disorders treatment program to like teach her how to eat. And I exclusively pumped for 6 months, but even that wasn't doing it. She just wasn't growing. So even now she's a tiny thing. She's 4 years old and we've like finally passed 30 pounds.
Wow.
She's very skinny. She's finally growing up. So we're like, we're finally making progress in that department. She's growing taller, but she is going to, honestly, we're probably going to be in the rear facing car seat. We joke about it. We're like, well, maybe by the time she's driving, she'll be able to turn around the other way.
Funny. Yes.
Because she is so small. But anyway, self-advocacy is so important on this journey. Did you have to learn how to advocate for yourself? And it sounds like you did really well, but did you have to learn about that? Or were you always a really good natural self-advocate?
No, I wish I was, because I think if I had pushed further or gone to different doctors, I might have gotten my Hashimoto's diagnosis sooner. It came more down to, I started researching more and I started, you know, Dr. Google is really good, unfortunately. And I started Googling my symptoms and I started finding out what would come up. And, or if I'd hear about something that was related to, let's just say the thyroid, I would start researching it and be like, that's exactly what sounds like is going on. And I finally, when we got the unexplained infertility diagnosis, I finally just said, okay, I want to go see other doctors. I want more opinions. And I said, I feel better on this thyroid medication. I'm going to an endocrinologist. And I finally just started putting my foot down and finding doctors who would be willing to do what needed to be done. And I think that's the thing. Like, we owe nothing to the doctors that we see. If they're not going to give us the care that we need, find a new one. They are great people and all, but they're people and this is their profession. And if they're not going to give us the things that we need, you need to go find one that will. And that was my mentality. Okay, well, this doctor is saying this. Okay, well, I'm going to find one closer to home and see if they say the same thing. And I had 2 OB-GYNs say the same thing, and then my endocrinologist. So the first OBGYN I won't go to. And funny thing is my mom goes to him for her annual exams. I go, stop seeing him. He's awful. I was not always great at it, but I think as I've gotten older, I've found my voice. I've found my way of researching and knowing, okay, this may or may not be what's wrong, but someone's going to tell me that it isn't. They're going to do the tests that need to be done.
Such a great point about how we don't owe them anything. It's interesting that we treat doctors differently than we treat other professionals in our life. For example, if you went to a car mechanic who did a not great job, you wouldn't go back to them.
Exactly.
And you wouldn't feel bad about it.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you got to remember that being a, you know, a doctor's office is a business too. And if they're not giving you what you need, you got to find someone who's going to. It's your health. It's your life. I mean, it's not even about getting pregnant at this point. It's just about, you got to, it's your health. You got to stay alive. You got to be healthy. And it's for yourself and your family. So you got to speak up. And if they don't want to listen to you when you speak up, find someone else.
How has infertility and this experience changed you?
Pretty much what we were just talking about. I think I've gotten more confident about myself. I do know myself. I've been become more self-aware of my body and what's going on and being able to talk to someone about it and talk to other people about it. Because maybe I've come across a lot of other people who've had fertility issues and they don't even know half the stuff that we're talking about right now. I found myself not being afraid to talk about it. I talk about it to anyone who will listen. I'm like, are you sure you want to talk about this? Because I'll talk your ear off. And so I really want to educate and force people to go to educate themselves about it if they think that might be what's wrong with them or not wrong with them. Just depends.
Knowing what you know now, what is one piece of advice that you give to your past self?
I think to not go down that dark path just because you didn't get the answer you were looking for to begin with. Try to still continue to be open-minded and formulate a plan and just grieve. Take that moment to grieve and then move on. I think I would have liked to have told myself to move on a little quicker to get answers. I didn't cry that long, but I mean, every time someone got pregnant, I was crying. And, you know, the other thing too is to be a better friend. I wasn't a good friend. You know, I had a friend who had two miscarriages and I'm like, well, at least you're getting pregnant. And that's not what they want to hear. That's not a good friend. And, you know, I'm over here in self-pity because I'm not getting pregnant at all. And I think I could have told myself to be a better friend, to be more supportive, to be there for them. And then when she finally did get pregnant and got pregnant and it stuck, I still wasn't necessarily, I was happy for her, but I still wasn't there for her. Still wasn't a good friend because I'm over here upset because she got pregnant. Why can't I get pregnant? Just to be a better friend, try to get out of your own self and be there for other people too, because, you know, everybody's going through something. You're not the only one.
To wrap up the episode, what words of hope would you offer to someone who's just beginning her infertility journey right now?
One thing for sure, don't be afraid to talk about it with other people, whether talk about it with people who will understand or who even will just listen to you. I think that's the best thing to do is don't hold it inside. Don't keep it to yourself and talk about it. Talk about it as much as you want to talk about it. And I think that is what will help get you through everything is talking about it, because keeping it inside is what makes it hard to handle. And just know that everything happens and it will happen. Honestly, I really believe that we wouldn't have our daughter if we didn't move out of the state and find this other fertility clinic. I really don't think we would. I am a firm believer that a lot of things happen for a reason and they'll happen in their own time. And that's not what anyone wants to hear. I certainly don't want to hear that. But just to keep the faith, keep advocating for yourself and talk about it, journal it, write it down. Just don't keep it bottled inside. And I can't say that it will happen because I don't know, but I hope that it does. I just hope it happens for you. I'm sure it will in one way or another.
Valerie, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. Hey, Infertility Warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. Regular listeners of the show know that I struggled during my infertility journey with everything from finding the right clinic to advocating for a protocol customized to my body to allowing infertility to consume my entire existence and everything in between. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side and have interviewed hundreds of other warriors and fertility experts, I've discovered the fastest way to realize your dream of becoming a parent is to get educated, regain hope, build resiliency, learn self-advocacy skills, and partner with someone who's been there. Whether you're an infertility newbie or a seasoned veteran, it would be my honor and privilege to provide, as one client put it, unwavering support with fully engulfing and genuine empathy. If you'd like to learn more or schedule a free 30-minute call to discuss how I can support you during your infertility journey, go to beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.